May it please the court, I am William Kane, registration number 7772, appearing on behalf of the appellant Robert Middleton. The party's limited partnership agreement provides that all claims and controversies arising between them under this partnership would be resolved through arbitration. The settlement agreement purporting to rescind that agreement to arbitrate states that obtaining a $600,000 loan for payment of part of the settlement to Mr. Middleton, and I'm quoting, shall be a condition preceding to each party's rights and obligations under the entire agreement. There is no dispute that that distribution loan, that's what it's called in the agreement, the $600,000 loan was not obtained. There is no dispute that no part of the $600,000 was paid to Mr. Middleton outside the distribution loan. It is my argument that all of the rights and obligations of the parties accordingly terminated under the terms of the settlement agreement, and that the language that I quoted above cannot be reconciled with the trial court's conclusion that the parties intended many of the provisions of the settlement agreement to survive, notwithstanding the failure to obtain the distribution loan.
The settlement agreement doesn't purport to say that the settlement agreement itself will be void or invalid in the event that the loan is not obtained. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, that language was not used, the language of the party's rights and obligations being conditioned upon the loan, to me, says the same thing.
Okay, but the settlement agreement, when it refers to the arbitration provision, simply says the parties agree to, I don't recall the exact language, to rescind the arbitration provision in the partnership agreement. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
If it's rescinded at that point, are there any further rights or obligations that do they require any additional condition for that particular provision, which is sort of in the present tense, to be altered?
There are some provisions of this agreement, the arbitration rescission is one of them, which took effect immediately. However, the language that the rights and obligations of the parties are conditioned upon obtaining the distribution loan and the rescission of the arbitration agreement simply reflected that there was going to be a period of time under which Ms. Loss would attempt to obtain a loan. And during that period of time, it's contemplated that Mr. Middleton, in contemplation of his ultimate exit from the partnership, is going to have a reduced role in the partnership. But the language was that all of the parties' rights and obligations under the entire agreement, which would include the rescission of arbitration clause, were conditioned upon the loan. So while there were some provisions which may have taken effect immediately in contemplation of the loan, once the loan did not get funded and paid or obtained, the parties are restored to the status quo under the agreement, under the language of that, the last part of paragraph 3. It's my argument that there's really no other way to interpret that language than that the parties are restored to the status quo if that loan is not obtained.
But rights and obligations were surviving after they rescinded the arbitration provision of the partnership agreement.
The right to be restored to the status quo if the settlement is not paid.
That means the loan is not obtained, you mean?
If the loan is not obtained, yeah. Along with another example is that Mr. Middleton says, okay, I won't be a general partner anymore. So for a period of time, he's not a general partner. I mean, partners are established or disestablished by consent of the partners. If the loan is not obtained and the entire agreement is unwound, then he becomes a general partner again by consent of the parties, as indicated in that condition precedent language. And the rescission of the arbitration agreement is restored to its status quo prior to that as well. The trial court offered two reasons for its conclusion. One was that the parties intended that the settlement, or some terms of the settlement agreement, survive as evidence of which it pointed to the $339,000 obtained by Mr. Middleton with the knowledge and consent of Ms. Law some years earlier, a couple of years before the settlement agreement was signed, as an indication that that would survive. And the second was that the addendum somehow modified the settlement agreement from one which was terminable automatically if the distribution loan was not obtained to one which could only be terminated by mutual agreement, and the court was incorrect on both of those. First, with respect to the severability issue, the court found in essence that the agreement was severable. Colorado law is to the contrary. Agreements are not severable unless the intent of both parties is clearly manifested in the agreement itself. And when we have language that rights and obligations under the entire agreement are conditioned, it's clear that there is no intent to sever. I do acknowledge that Ms. Loss testified that when she signed the agreement, she thought some of the provisions were severable, that they would survive the failure to obtain the distribution loan. That testimony does not support the conclusion of the trial court under Univex and Cornerstone and John v. United Advertising. The intent to have a severable agreement must be clearly manifested in the agreement, and it must show the intent of both parties to make it severable. Not only here do we have the language of paragraph 3 against severability, but Mr. Middleton certainly testified that it was not his intent that these agreements would be severable.
But reject Mr. Middleton's testimony in favor of that of Ms. Loss?
Well, I suppose it could, but the Univex case in particular says that the intention to sever must be by both parties, and it must be manifested in the agreement. Cornerstone says that when the language of an agreement is clear, the issue is one of law. In other words, if there is no intent to sever expressed in the agreement, it doesn't matter what the intent of the parties was. And I submit that there is the quoted language concerning the condition precedent is an anti-severability clause, and it refers expressly to the entire agreement, not just parts of it. The retention by Mr. Middleton of the $339,000 is as a resolution of whatever dispute may have existed concerning that, is also not a severable agreement. There's no indication in the the $339,000 to begin with is a passing reference that he had already received it. That's all that the settlement agreement says about it. The settlement agreement does not say if you can't get the distribution loan, you have to pay it back. It doesn't say if you can't get the distribution loan, you get to keep it. All that happens under the condition precedent language is that if you can't get the distribution loan, the settlement agreement is unwound and the parties start from square one by going back to mediation, which in this case occurred without result. The addendum did nothing more than extend the deadline for obtaining the loan from March 1, 2010 to July 31, 2010. The court found differently. The court said that addendum changed the agreement from one which terminated automatically to one which required mutual consent to terminate. And I submit that that is a clearly erroneous conclusion, that there is no evidence in the record to support that. That was the issue on which the court wanted to hear evidence, and the evidence on that supports the appellant completely. The recital in the addendum says this is simply to maintain the agreement, settlement agreement in effect while the Ms. Lass attempts to obtain the loan. The evidence from not only Mr. Middleton, but Ms. Lass's lawyer at the time, Mr. DeVore testified that the purpose of the addendum was simply to maintain the agreement in effect and nothing else. And that's the context of the language. There is language in the addendum that talks about terminating the agreement, and that is due to the fact that also in paragraph 3, the parties had agreed that if the distribution loan could not be obtained, the parties would return to mediation. And so the addendum says we'll extend to July 31, and if we don't have the loan by then, we can either, one, agree to extend further, two, go back to mediation per paragraph 3, or three, decide that the settlement is done, mediation is useless, and terminate the agreement. It was not, it's not within the language of the addendum, and clearly there's no evidence that anybody intended for this addendum to modify the condition precedent language. Ms. Lass testified twice at the hearing, and she did not dispute either Mr. Middleton's testimony about the discussion at the meeting that led to the agreement, that there was no discussion to delete the condition precedent language, nor dispute the testimony of her own attorney that it was not intended, that there was nothing intended beyond extending the agreement. And so there is no evidence in this record which supports the trial court's conclusion that the addendum was intended to modify the settlement agreement and write out the condition precedent language. I would like to reserve my remaining time, absent any questions on what I've said so far, for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, David Masters for the appellee, Catherine Lass. My registration number is 15869. I want to start with talking about this condition precedent provision upon which the appellant places so much evidence. If you look at that language and pull it separately out of that paragraph, it says what it says, that it is a obtaining the distribution loan is a condition precedent to all rights and all obligations under the agreement. Well, now we can take a step back and look at the whole agreement and see what the obligations are. And the first obligation of Ms. Lass is to use her best efforts to try to obtain that loan. So the appellant's reading of the last sentence of paragraph 3 says that before she must use her best efforts, she must obtain the loan. Well, that doesn't make any sense. So there is a way to...
Didn't she have to do both?
Well, her obligation, Your Honor, is to use her best efforts.
And not to obtain the loan by a specific date?
She has to use her best efforts to obtain the loan by a date certain. Okay? That's her obligation. I can't explain how that obligation can be subject to that condition precedent. I think, explain what is subject to that condition precedent. But before I get to that, let's go back to the addendum. The addendum is a short, one-page document. Its language, as we argued in the trial court, is not ambiguous. It says that if no loan has been obtained by July 31, 2010, the parties will return to mediation absent agreement to do either of two things: extend the loan deadline further or agree to terminate the settlement agreement. They did neither. Okay? The parties did not extend the loan deadline, and they did not agree to terminate the settlement agreement. Therefore, the settlement agreement remained in effect. And the parties were obligated to return to mediation, which they did. It was unsuccessful.
What does the settlement agreement look like at that point?
The settlement
agreement, you're saying, is totally intact again?
It is, Your Honor.
But with the deletion of the condition precedent, even though that wasn't specifically addressed?
I don't think that the condition precedent is deleted at that point. I believe the entire settlement agreement remains in place. Okay, but her obligation to use her best efforts to try to obtain that loan by a date certain and then an extended date certain, she did that. Okay, we went to a hearing on this. There was they did not. The appellant has not taken the position that Ms. Loss breached the agreement by failing to use her best efforts. Counsel for the appellant was pressed on that issue in the trial court, conceded that that was not what the position that they were taking. She used her best efforts, okay? The loan did not materialize. It was not available, okay? So
what happened to that condition preceding, if you're saying the settlement agreement remained in effect?
Well, I think the best way to answer your question is to explain to you what the appellee's position is, what that condition precedent applies to. If you look at the settlement agreement, the object here was to buy out a partner and to do it through this funding mechanism of recognizing that he had already received $339,000 and that he would receive the proceeds of the distribution loan, and then the parties, including the partnership, would place conservation easements on partnership property, generate tax credits, sell those tax credits, use the proceeds from the sale of those tax credits to pay off the loan and to pay the additional $600,000 to Mr. Middleton. The bulk of those provisions, the real operative terms of this agreement, are found in paragraph 4. And that's where it is laid out what the parties are going to do if and when the distribution loan has been obtained. But if the distribution loan has been attained, then these rights and obligations that we see in paragraph 4 are suspended. Okay, that's the condition precedent. If we don't have a distribution loan, there's no reason for Mr. Middleton to be required to go out and do the work necessary to implement or place conservation easements on the property. There's no obligation to go sell the resulting tax credits. The paragraph 4 talks about details in terms of when conservation easements are going to be placed on the property, how many home sites there can be, because those affect the value of the property to be measured before and after the conservation easement, which has an impact on the size of the tax credit. all those kinds of fine details, the terms and conditions for creation of the conservation easements, who's going to pay the taxes if there are any tax consequences, the application of the proceeds from the sale of the tax credits. That's all in paragraph 4 of the agreement, and that is what the last sentence of section 3 says is subject to a condition preceding of getting the loan. Because if we don't have the loan, there's no sense going forward with this conservation easement tax credit process. If we go back and look at the agreement itself, the settlement agreement, it was effective immediately when it was signed. And as I've already argued, it remains in effect. And I believe that can be seen from the plain language of the agreement. If we look at the first paragraph, Mr. Middleton immediately withdraws his demand for arbitration. Okay? His obligation was to withdraw the demand for arbitration was not conditioned on the obligation of Ms. Loss to obtain the distribution loan. This was something that was to happen immediately. Paragraph 2, Mr. Middleton acknowledges that he has previously received $339,000. Okay? That acknowledgement was effective immediately. It's not something that is rescinded simply because she fails, was not able to obtain the loan. The appellant says the agreement's terminated, everybody's in their status quo ante. Well, I don't know if you've looked at the record, but the trial court judge pressed pretty hard on this issue. What about the $339,000? If everybody goes back to, we're going to unwind this thing, Mr. Middleton has to give that money back. And he said, oh, no, that's an entirely separate agreement. So that argument.
What's your position on that?
My position is that if there is no agreement, if this agreement is completely unwound, then he's obligated to pay her $339,000.
That would be the subject of review. Lawsuit rather than an arbitration.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That issue wouldn't be arbitrable. The obligation to pay back the money.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't think it is a dispute that, quote, arises under the partnership agreement.
As I hasn't addressed in the partnership agreement, the settlement agreement, or the addendum, is it?
It is not, Your Honor. As I said at the outset, if we look at paragraph 3, when we say the settlement agreement was effective immediately, okay, her immediate obligation, the obligation of Ms. Laws, as seen in paragraph 3, is to go out and use her best efforts to try to obtain the loan. That obligation was not, could not have been subject to a condition precedent that she obtained the loan. Paragraph 5. This shows, this is a good example of the party's intention that various provisions, if need be, of this agreement stand separately. Because this provision, paragraph 5, begins with the phrase, upon execution. Upon execution, Mr. Middleton's interest in the partnership became only that of a limited partner. Paragraph 6, the parties acknowledged that Ms. Loss had previously received property and that required no further treatment under the settlement agreement. Okay? That is a done deal. That representation, acknowledgement, and agreement between the parties was effective immediately. It is not something subject to being revisited. Paragraph 10, like paragraph 5, begins with the phrase, upon execution. It altered the fiduciary duties of Ms. Loss, but clearly...
Aren't you really reading out the provision that says in paragraph 3, obtaining the loan called for herein shall be a condition preceding to each party's rights and obligations under the entire agreement?
I'm trying not to read it out, Your Honor.
What does that mean? What
it means is, I guess the part that I would have to read out is the entire agreement part. But standing alone,
we're not entitled as a court to read out language in the agreement, are we?
I don't believe you are. Your obligation is to try to reconcile the language in the agreement. And when we look at that last sentence, paragraph 3, where it says condition preceding all rights and obligations, entire agreement, how can you reconcile that? How can we, or you as the court, reconcile that with paragraph 10 that says upon execution, paragraph 5 that says upon execution? How can you reconcile it with the perhaps the principal obligation of Ms. Loss under this agreement to use her best efforts to obtain the distribution loan? How can obtaining the loan, we have to get the loan before it's her obligation to use her best efforts, if we make an absolutely strict reading of the last sentence of paragraph 3? I think that a good fair reading of the last sentence of paragraph 3 is to say the rights and obligations it's talking about, what being conditioned upon obtaining the loan, are those rights and obligations dealing with the creation of conservation easements, the sale of tax credits, the distribution of proceeds from the sale of tax credits, who's going to pay taxes, and all of that fine detail that's contained in paragraph 4. Otherwise, if
the entire agreement would seem to refer to more than just paragraph 4.
It certainly would. It would include the beginning of paragraph 3, where it says her obligation is to use her best efforts. And that, we could perhaps agree, creates an ambiguity. And if there is an ambiguity between what that last sentence says and the rest of the provisions of this agreement, then the trial court held a hearing, took evidence, heard testimony from Mr. Middleton, heard testimony from Ms. Loss, made its findings and resolved the ambiguity and said the parties intended to preserve certain provisions, particularly the waiver of arbitration. My time's almost up, unless you have further questions. Thank you.
Help me with it. Say part of paragraph 3 has to be read out. What language specifically are you talking about?
I guess if I would have to say that piece about entire agreement, because if we make a condition preceding on the rights and obligations of the entire agreement, then that phrase itself doesn't make sense, because you can't make her obligation to get the to use her best efforts subject to the condition of obtaining the loan. Thank you.
Mr. Kane.
Thank you. Let's not lose track in talking about the arbitration provision, that the heart of this agreement for Mr. Middleton was not that he hoped to exit the agreement, but that he would the partnership, but that he would actually get paid $1,200,000, $600,000 of which would be paid through this initial loan. That is at the heart of the agreement. And it's at the heart of the argument that the entire, when there is a condition precedent language that says getting this loan is the condition to the party's rights and obligations under the entire agreement, it's because of that. This is really important, that the loan get obtained and that he get paid. To echo Judge Kopelke's questions to Mr. Masters, and also Your Honor, to try to take a final stab at answering the question you directed to me about what rights and obligations remain under the arbitration agreement, I obviously read the under the entire agreement literally. And under the entire agreement cannot mean the entire agreement except paragraph 17 on arbitration, or except paragraph 5 on partnership interest, or except paragraph 10 on, I know it was mentioned, but I've forgotten what that applies to. How do we reconcile that language with certain things that were done immediately? And that's clear, that's reconcilable in the context of this. It was going to take some time for Ms. Loss to make her best efforts to get this loan. The parties knew that. The parties knew that a third party would be involved. And the parties knew that the ultimate goal of this settlement was to have Mr. Middleton exit the partnership agreement completely and have Ms. Loss be as the sole partner. So during that period, there are transitional provisions which say he's not going to be a general partner and he's not going to be owed fiduciary duties as a general partner. But under the language of under the entire agreement, he is entitled to be restored to all of his rights and obligations under every paragraph of that agreement without the loan and without the funds that were at the heart of this. One brief comment as to the $339,000. There is no obligation in this partnership agreement or in the settlement agreement or anywhere else that he has to pay it back if it goes bust. My argument is that the $339,000, any claim that Ms. Middleton or Ms. Loss has against Mr. Middleton as to that issue is restored along with all the other rights and obligations under that agreement. Whether she's entitled to that $339,000 remains to be seen. Her claim is restored. Nothing would obligate him to repay it immediately because it was a disputed issue.
But that would be the topic of, in your view, an arbitration.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah, the payment was received in exchange for conveyance of partnership property to Mr. Middleton so he could put conservation easements on it, sell the tax credits arising from those conservation easements, and retain the money. It was a partnership act all the way. So I believe that would be the subject of arbitration as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments, gentlemen. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.